Thank you all for joining us for the summit, and for those of you on the webcast, thank you for joining us as well. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce John Stevens, who's going to be talking about AT&T in their first visit to our summit. John, I'm really delighted to have you here today.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it. Hey, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Yeah, these chairs are almost too comfortable.
Yeah.
We'll do our best to stay awake. John, I'll let you give your safe harbor in just a second with your first answer. Let me just kick it off, because you guys certainly have a lot going on in your business. Maybe the place to start is with your vertical integration strategy, with a big deal that is pending. Take us back to the genesis of the vertical integration strategy, and just talk about how you plan to leverage the combination of assets of now distribution, DIRECTV, and ultimately, the content from Time Warner.
Sure. Greg, thanks for having us here. Thanks for everyone in the room. Today's conversation will include forward-looking statements that are subject to risks and uncertainties. You can find further information on our website or in our SEC filings. I think that'll satisfy all our legal disclosure requirements. Secondly, I usually do this at the end, but I want to do this right from the start. It's one message. If no other message you get from me today, one message you walk away from today is, a couple hundred thousand people a year are either killed or seriously injured from distracted driving car accidents. As a company who provides cellular service to millions and millions of customers, we really don't want any revenue from people who are using our devices while they're driving. You can cost a life. You can ruin a life. If you don't do it for yourselves, if you don't do it for your families, if you don't do it for your neighbors, do it for my grandchildren. We really don't need anyone to be distracted while they're driving, so please, it can wait. It definitely can wait. With that said, with regard to our fully integrated strategy, let's take a step back and make sure, first of all, we're a fully integrated network carrier. Whether it's in our wireless and extensive wireless holdings and extensive wireless capabilities, whether it's an extensive fiber footprint, whether it's an extensive traditional wireline network, whether it's our satellite distribution, we are the integrated carrier, so we have the capability to deliver services to customers anywhere they live and work, anywhere they want. With that, we found that premium content was critical to that. Both not only content, but premium content was critical to the success of that. That is what customers really wanted. The Time Warner transaction clearly has significant content, but the more important thing, it's of the highest quality. The ability to do that and take that and incorporate it in, if you will, converge it with our various delivery and capability services is phenomenal. From that perspective, that's where it came from. It started with this network integration and has moved on to now what the customers want, what are they focused on, and they want this ability to have this content anywhere they live and work, anywhere they want to use it. With regard to that, it's also, quite frankly, from a financial perspective, just a really very attractive transaction in the sense of the diversity of the revenue growth perspectives, the cash flow growth perspectives, if you will, the payout ratio improvements. Quite frankly, the diversity of revenue from a regulatory perspective, even though the regulatory environment has certainly significantly improved over the last 6 months, Time Warner and its content revenues are much less regulated than our traditional business. The CapEx intensity characteristics are very positive for our business. So from all those aspects of it, it was a very attractive transaction. And then quite frankly, the leadership at Time Warner is, at least on our part, very, very well respected. Great talent. Jeff Bukas, my counterpart, Howard Avery, all do a great job and are great to work with and have great teams. And so that's another critical aspect of why this thing works for us.
Can you preview some of the things that you can do uniquely with the vertical integration strategy, whether it's you've already done a lot with bundling DIRECTV with wireless and what have you. Can you just give us a sort of sneak peek at some of the things the ideas that keep you excited at night when you think, wow, I can't wait until we get this and here's what we can do?
Sure, and Greg, you touched on one, but I mean, 6 million customers already are bundling our wireless and our video products, and that goes to not only a really great experience, but quite frankly, our smartphone churn in the first quarter was 0.9. It was, you know, dramatic, really great. So you can see the actual financial results in our business from doing that. If you look at our recent Unlimited Choice, Unlimited Plus products, you can see where Unlimited Plus, we're adding to it the ability to have DTV or DTV Now at a real value rate, a $25 coupon, the ability to put HBO on that. What we've seen so far, it's early in these offerings, what we've seen so far is a really great response from our customers. We're really pleased with them. So those are some of the things. If you go deeper, though, and you say, I've got this company who's got 25 million distribution points on video, 15 million plus distribution points on broadband, maybe 100 million distribution points on wireless when you talk about tablets and phones, you got this tremendous amount of data. And when you take that data and say, hey, you know, Warner Studios, this is what people are actually watching. This is what they're engaging in. This is what they want to look at. Can you take this information and help you in the production side of how you choose movies and what projects you want to do? Hey, Turner and TBS, you know, and Cartoon Network and Adult Swim, and you know, here is what viewers are actually looking at. And on your digital properties, this is what they're looking at on the cell phones. And can you take this information and really learn more about your business? We all went through the election cycle, and quite frankly, the pollsters, I think all of us would agree, were inaccurate. We all witnessed what happened with Brexit and the EU leaving that, and I think all of us would agree that most of the pollsters had it wrong. That same kind of data is what the content industry uses today. What we will offer is detailed, real viewing information, real usage information that can be used first and foremost, in simply in the production, in the decision-making, in the internal workings. Secondly, it's going to be that same information can be used for advertising services, marketing services, by advertising companies say, what are customers really watching? What do they really cling to? We can use it there. And, of course, you can use it in this combined company to be more effective with your advertising.
Yeah.
Those are really great opportunities across the board. I will tell you, the ability to have really high-quality talent on the video side to then take videos and curate them and modify them for use on the wireless screen, for use on, you know, on the phone screen, for the use on the tablet. Having people who do this with great skill and talent is a huge opportunity so that we can curate, we can develop, we can get customer-focused delivery of video products that we probably aren't nearly as qualified to do on our own. It would be much more difficult to do on our own.
Now, I want to talk about Time Warner just as a business for a second, separate from the synergy opportunities. The cable nets business is a business that faces some real secular challenges, and that's still a big part of what you're buying. Talk about the way you see the cable nets business and sort of what within the mix of assets. They've got studio, movie studio, television studio, HBO.
So Warner, great studio, you know, wins awards, Emmys, Oscars, year in and year out, have a great, if you will, business relationship with talent and the ability to retain talent and produce talent. So from that standpoint, you know, really great opportunity. We might be able to provide them support from administrative sides or from technical sides, but great talent in and of themselves, great reputation. What really adds to that is a phenomenal library. And so when you think of this distribution of wireless, 100 million points, if you think of the distribution of broadband, you think of distribution on video, and suddenly you have now this tremendous high, some would say it's the best library out there, certainly one of the best, but many people would tell you it's the best library of content out there. And the ability to use that throughout the business and to coordinate it gives a whole new meaning to this this merger. When you look at Turner and you think about four of their stations are in the top kind of 50, really closer to the top 40, and three of them are in the top 20, of rated stations out there. So as the bundle changes, as we go from 300 channels to something other than that, you know, 85, almost 90% of their revenues are in those top 40 channels. Gives the finance team very great, you know, good feeling about the reliability. And then when you think of the quality of their products that they have and the shows that they have, the sports contracts they have, feel really good about that. Now the ability then to, once again, curate that, use it differently, deliver it over a tablet, deliver it over a phone. The curation gives us a lot of excitement. Using a coordinated effort on a digital delivery service. So instead of DTV Now being a platform we're developing and CNN Digital and so on and so forth, all being separately done, the ability to take our resources and say, let's just come out with the best digital platform for all our properties. That cost-saving item and that quality and that speed of delivery is really important. And then you go to HBO and you think of just a really, you know, the industry, the player in the industry that's got the best capabilities to deliver an over-the-top, you know, video on demand, pay quality, and the ability, as we've done studies where in many cases it's more attractive to put HBO on your phone than it is to give you a free phone. Many of our customers value the HBO more than they value a free piece of equipment. So those kinds of things are where we see the activities. And as I say, it's just it's a tremendously high quality product and company and great results. It also will fit very well, mesh well with what we have, our capabilities and skills together.
Well, let's talk about DirecTV for a second. That's another business where the pay TV category as a whole suffered a very challenging quarter with real acceleration in cord cutting. You've talked about that as that you clearly went into DirecTV with an expectation that that was going to happen. Can you talk about the trajectory of cord cutting and how you think about that business and going forward?
Sure. So you're right in the sense that we expected the pay TV business on the other side to come down, and then there'd be other opportunities on over the top and other delivery mechanisms. I can tell you the first, from July of 15 through the end of last year, our satellite performance was better than we had expected in our kind of modeling and our forethought. In the first quarter, we gave some of that back. When you look at the first quarter for us, there was a lot of involuntary churn. We had been aggressive in last year. And had sought after some customers that we previously hadn't sought after, some packages and some offerings. And quite frankly, we went too far, and about half the churn we had, or about half the customer losses, just under half the customer losses we had, were involuntary in the quarter. So that was a business decision we made to go after them. It was a business decision we made to adjust the numbers in the first quarter. So that's just what happened. With regard to that, though, if you will, you know, more or less we're kind of in line on a customer count base on the satellite side with where we expected to be. We are continuing to work on DTV Now. We're continuing to work on our other over-the-top, whether it's Otter Media partnership, whether it's the other things we've got going, to develop that opportunity to sell to those 20 million households that don't have a paid TV subscription. And the ability to have the content relationships today through the DirecTV subscriber base, through the UVerse subscriber base, gives us a footing to go put those kind of products together.
So before we talk about DirecTV Now and that transition, how do we think about the trajectory of the traditional satellite business going forward?
I think it's the same as we had when we bought it, that it will be a, we think we can hold or maybe improve market share, but in a business that the overall linear TV will be coming down. We think it's got a slower trajectory than many do, but we do think it'll be coming then.
Fair enough. And so now let's talk about DirecTV Now. Has that met your expectations? And how should investors think about and measure success for DirecTV Now?
Yeah, no, it has met our expectations. Actually, kind of was phenomenal results in December. The promotions we put with the Fire Stick and the Apple TV were overwhelming, positive. Great. After we did that, we said, okay, let's now that we've got that big customer base built, let's go test the let's go test the system, let's go test the platform. And let's focus our efforts in that first quarter on really improving the platform, making sure we get all the technical kinks out, making sure the customers get the best quality experience. That's what we did. We weren't focused on putting a lot more sales on. We wanted to see how the promotions reacted from a churn perspective. We continued to add customers throughout the quarter, so that's a great thing. And our next step is to add, as you may have heard, we've announced we've added 14 Fox affiliates. Local stations are now going to be added to the package. We're adding some more premium content. We're looking to do things like features like a cloud DVR and those kinds of things. Those are the things we're going to be working on now, and we'll be ready. We expect to release in the second half of the year. For a overall success base, we feel good about where we're at. If you're asking me, do we have a targeted specific number of subscribers that I'm ready to announce? No, I don't. And quite frankly, I don't mean to be flippant about that, but it's really very directly, we're going to go through a merger with Time Warner, who's got some pretty good products and brands, things like HBO, and some pretty good digital offerings, and we're going to need to go through that process and make sure we figure out which is the best ones to take. But the development of DTV Now is really important in the sense of having the opportunity to go into those 20 million households who don't have a paid TV, the people who don't want to maybe want to have an alternative delivery system. They want to get it wirelessly as opposed to a dish, or they may not have cable where they're at. They have the fiber connections. So it's really important to have that and have that platform. And so we feel good about the progress we've made.
And why the choice not to disclose subscribers for DirecTV Now in the first quarter?
Because pretty simply, we've got 145 million wireless customers, 25 million TV customers, and 16 million broadband customers, and we serve everybody in the Fortune 1000. These numbers aren't material. And so we don't want to get into a situation where we want to manage the business with a focus on the quality of the product, as opposed to saying, oh, we were up, 3,000 this month and down 1,000 next month. We want to focus everybody on what's the best thing for the product and the offering.
And one last question before we turn away from DirecTV Now. How do I think about the customer lifetime value of DirecTV Now subscribers? You've got enviably high margins in DirecTV, but that's both a blessing and a curse, right? I mean, those customers are extraordinarily high-value customers. Is there any way to replace that with DirecTV Now customers, or do you have to look to the value of what they bring in wireless churn to get the value?
Yeah, we're not looking at DTV Now as a replacement for DTV. We're looking for DTV Now as a way to give customers a service that they wouldn't otherwise have, whether it be when I'm traveling and being able to watch TV easily and very conveniently on my tablet, or whether it's one of my one of my children don't have a full subscription because they're not interested in, for example, sports. My daughters, my son-in-law don't have an interest in sports, so they prefer DTV Now. They don't have it makes it very easy for them. They can take it where they want. They really like it. It's touching those that we wouldn't otherwise touch. It's a product offering. That's the point on it. If you then can bundle it with wireless, whether it's what we're doing today with our traditional postpaid product, but if we can then get it in a bundle with prepaid, and you can get other products added on, then, bundling it with Cricket, for example, then we can touch a market that we underserve today. And if you can, if you will, get that relationship built with them, when they become a more traditional homeowner, more traditional buyer of our services, we already have the relationship, we already have the commonality with our products and services, that's a great offering. We're doing this very, very successfully with Cricket. We started that over 3 years ago when we got into the prepaid business in a different way. It was a much different view for us, but we are extremely pleased with how it has performed, and we think it's a great sign that looking to touch those customer base that we wouldn't normally touch, that we wouldn't normally address, is certainly a worthy endeavor, and that's what DTV Now provides that opportunity to do. As well as a guy like me who likes having that convenience of having the icon on my tablet, turning it on and being able to watch it wherever I am, whether I'm waiting for the waiting for a plane or in between meetings or in my hotel room when I'm traveling.
Well, not for nothing, but isn't it interesting that we've been talking for now getting close to half the session, and we've been talking all about entertainment and media types of businesses instead of wireless and wireline. And it's a sort of glimpse of the future, maybe, of the new AT&T and how much your portfolio has changed.
Yeah, generally, it is a glimpse of that. Generally, a person, you know, a finance guy with my background is not one people talk about content. So it is a surprise.
So, well, let's turn to the wireless business for a second.
Sure.
First, you know, the first quarter was a challenging quarter for the industry. What are you seeing in the second quarter so far in terms of competitive intensity? And, you know, is it any more measured than it was in the first quarter?
Sure. So, first of all, the unlimited offers, and specifically the change in process by the, you know, one of our competitors to go to unlimited, you know, changed things in the first quarter. When Verizon did that, we took a breath and said, okay, what are we going to do? We took a methodical approach. We didn't immediately respond. And because of that, there was some disruption in our customer accounts. Since we've come back with our unlimited choice, unlimited plus plans, and quite frankly, it happened then, but even since we've added HBO to our unlimited plus offering, we've had really great customer accounts kind of, you know, really turn to a very good situation. So we feel good about that. One thing I want to point to, though, is we had record EBITDA margins in our wireless business in the first quarter of right under 42%. So we have a lot of noise about this, but the team is really performing on a generation of value basis. And secondly, if you look, we had some really good performance on our smartphone postpaid churn, 0.9. We had good performance on our prepaid. So, yes, there was a lot of noise. And, yes, there was some competitive pressure. But I want to step back and make sure the team that runs that business did a really great job for us and had a good financial quarter. Next step is this. If everybody in the industry wants to go to a competition level that's based on capacity, because if you go to unlimited, you're then competing on capacity. If you want to go to capacity, we didn't start this. We weren't the first movers here. But my goodness, we are by far, without question, best positioned to compete in that. 60 megahertz of spectrum that we're now have a, now not only are putting in the heavy ability to put into service to dramatically improve or dramatically expand our capacity, but we also have a check from the federal government on a co-pay arrangement to pay for most of it, $6.5 billion through our FirstNet contract. We have a FirstNet contract that gives us this 2x10, 700 megahertz, very, very high-quality low-band spectrum that they negotiated with us and we negotiated with them that we can use this for our commercial customers. We can use this for our day-to-day needs. Now, granted, they can use our overall network for FirstNet customers. So they got, you know, $100 billion worth of assets and $60 billion worth of spectrum to use for FirstNet. We get to use the 700 spectrum and that capacity for our day-to-day customers. But if you think about that, if you want to move to a capabilities or a competitive environment that's based on capacity, we feel very, very good about our position. We are like no other. This is something that we can do today, that we're doing today, whether it's this deep fiber footprint we've had from our legacy companies or the expansion that we did with VIP or the extensive fiber we're putting in to satisfy some of our commitments with the DTD transaction, whether it's four-way carrier aggregation and four-way MIMO and the 500 meg speeds we got in Austin on our LTE network last quarter in our test there, whether it's air gig and the new technology and the patents we have around delivering broadband to the home, whether it's the testing we did with the 28 gigahertz in Austin to provide a 1 gig, you know, millimeter wave service, or whether it's the leadership we're providing on the 5G standards. We are like no one else. There's a lot of stories out there. Nobody's got the capacity, capabilities, and quite frankly, the progress already today and in the near term, dramatic additional progress. We feel very good about that. We didn't start down this road, but if that's where it's going to take us, we will be in very, very good shape and completely different than anybody else you'll hear at this conference.
Well, let me ask you a question. A question that I just asked your counterpart at Verizon in the last session is: do you believe in network advantage as a wireless strategy anymore? There's certainly a sense from a lot of investors that the age of network differentiation is behind us, and that that's sort of a bleak future for wireless. I'm guessing you would disagree, but is there a path for AT&T to really assert network advantage and keep network from being a commodity?
Yes. First and foremost, it's what we talked about at the very start, the converged product set and the ability to deliver video and curated.
So the core to that is what content, not just the network itself.
It ties together. But secondly, it's this ability that as content grows dramatically, networks can get full, networks can get constrained, and whether it's through whatever means, people can get quality that can erode or not be as high. We are not that company. In fact, we're on a road to even improve what we're already providing. The second piece for us, though, is if you do this as our network team has laid out, if you do this at the same time you're doing network function virtualization or converting it to a software-defined network, you can do this and then lower the ongoing operating costs. So dramatically lower the per megabit cost to deliver the service. So you get higher quality at a really efficient price. We believe that that is critical to the financial competitive advantage we'll have for ourselves, for our shareholders, for our customers. The ability to sustain that is provided by that. So it's a multi-step process that the team's going through. It's just that the FirstNet contract provided us 2x10, 20 megahertz nationwide spectrum and a $6.5 billion copay to really jumpstart us in this process.
And so bottom line, as we look out for the wireless business, when do you see revenue stabilization in that business?
We'll see it as network capacity in other people's networks start to fill. We'll see it as we get the build out of the FirstNet, so we have this capability to sell FirstNet services, but also smart cities, but a nationwide platform of Internet of Things. We're seeing it today, and we'll see more of it in our Mexico wireless business. And it's a real distinction for us because we've got 100 million customer capabilities just south of the United States that is growing revenues, growing very, very fast in constant currency, and growing in U.S. dollars, but growing dramatically fast in constant currency, adding 3 million customers last year. So we'll get it from there. So for us, we'll see it from all of those aspects. As I say, this balance that we're going through, and we're continuing to add prepaid customers at a real strong clip. That has a benefit for today, but quite frankly, it has a benefit in future years as those customers may change and migrate up to bigger plans.
Let's talk about network densification and particularly the path to 5G for a minute. You looked at straight path, decided not to chase it. How confident are you? You've got your fiber tower spectrum and you have some spectrum, but how confident are you in the millimeter wave business as a business plan? Have you seen enough yet to give you some confidence that there's a real return on investment there for building out the density that's going to be required at those spectrum bands?
Yeah, so let me say it this way. We're extremely confident in our overall wireless network strategy. For us, it's a comprehensive strategy. It doesn't just rely on millimeter wave working or not working. It's comprehensive. It's the deep spectrum position we have. It's the deep fiber. We have more fiber out there than I think anybody, based on our legacy businesses, based on what we're doing with fiber to the prem, based on the number of businesses passed. It's based on all of it. So the millimeter wave is an important piece to it. Our fiber tower holdings, opportunity for fiber tower holdings, because we don't have FCC approval yet. But we do think we're going to get a meaningful footprint out of that at a very, very attractive price that will allow us to build out in the 39 gigahertz space. You guys can look at the filings. They have somewhere under license, somewhere in the just under 400 megahertz nationwide. So we'll work through. They've got some challenges that we'll work through with the FCC, but we're encouraged that we'll get a meaningful footprint to build off of. But our strategy doesn't just rely on that. We can get fiber to the home with AirGig. We can get broadband to the home with AirGig. We can get broadband to the home with fiber. We can get broadband to the home with fixed wireless local loop. When you think about most of the non-urban areas of the country and you think of the low-band spectrum we're going to have in service, there's going to be a tremendous mobile broadband speed capabilities that you can get from that process. So we're optimistic about millimeter wave helping. I think its small cells backhaul will be very good. I think getting 5G, not necessarily millimeter wave, but 5G into the core network will be very, very helpful. We will see how millimeter wave as a broadband replacement to the home works out. We're interested in it because we've got so much local footprint that we can leverage off of that millimeter wave of the home and offload it onto our own network, making owners' economics really sensible. The challenge for others is if you don't own that network, you have to pay freight to somebody on that, and that's what causes it. So we'd love for it to work for us because we're in the best economic position, but it's not our only game. The network team's done a great job of having multiple choices in this ongoing trip or ongoing path to the best, continuing to have the best quality, highest speed, deepest network.
You mentioned the wireline business and the synergy between wireless and wireline, which I think has really reignited investors' imaginations in the last year or two as people have come to view them as much more complementary than I think a couple of years back.
I appreciate you saying that because we've stuck by our wireline business, and people have had differing opinions on that, but that integrated carrier model, which has led to the converged content and distribution model, is something that we believed in for years. This is not, and I point that out. There's some long-term consistency and reliability to our strategy and our story. We actually follow through on a long number of years on a consistent pattern, a consistent thought, and we're proud of that, and it's working for us.
So one of the businesses there, U-verse Broadband.
Sure.
Was actually one of the highlights of the quarter. You did a
IP Broadband did very well.
You did real well in IP Broadband or IP Broadband. Talk about that for a second.
Couple of things. One, we put a lot of fiber out there, and that's helped. Secondly, we're getting through the DSL legacy business. If you look at the numbers, it's 6%, 5% of the total broadband is in that DSL. The rest of it's in the IP Broadband. So we kind of got through that the maturity process, that migration process.
And so is that a growth business again?
Once again, on a long-term basis, absolutely. On a quarter-by-quarter basis, I got to tell you, second quarter is traditionally a seasonal business that's challenged for that quarter. But yes, it's going to be a growth business for a lot of reasons. But one of the better ones is that we continue to maximize our utilization of the fiber we have out there, and we're adding to it. We'll have 6 million fiber to the prem by the end of the year. We'll have 12.5 by the middle of 19. And quite frankly, the 12.5 is a commitment number that we've made to the FCC. But quite frankly, because of the way the counting works, we'll probably have closer to 13 or 14 million fiber to the prem locations by 2020 or so. It'll just be the way the numbers work. So that's a really great opportunity.
And what kind of return are you seeing on that? I mean, is it? I know that that was part of a commitment that you made in order to get the DirecTV deal done, but have you found that to be sort of an attractive investment in its own right that says I'd be happily doing this anyway?
On the standalone basis, it's meeting our investment projections and it's meeting our ROIC standards. The exciting part about it, though, you know, that's a longer-term payout, as most network assets are, network investments are, but it's good, solid returns. But the exciting part about it is what it's doing to churn when you bundle it with wireless, when you bundle it with video, when it gives us that capability, you know, when it eliminates us, our position as a one-product offering to the home. Because now I can, now with the video offering, whether it's a UVerse or whether it's satellite or a DTV now I have the broadband to go with it. And so that bundling, as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing, you know, our quad play products are seeing some pretty significant, very, very measurable reductions in churn, and we're making progress on that. Most significant of the inwards on the broadband in particular are bundled. And so broadband standalone, good product. We're getting the returns that we expected. The real value is the ability to bundle it with other things.
And we talked about IP broadband as one of the strong points. One of the softer spots in the quarter was on the commercial wireline business, where those declines accelerated meaningfully. Can you talk about what was the source of that softness?
So two pieces of it. One is the strategic services continued to grow. They grew at about 8% level. We saw continued slow business fixed investment. I think most of you saw the GDP growth rates of 0.7. in the first quarter, and we tend to trail. You know, we tend to trail some of the response on GDP growth. Our strategic services did really well in an environment where there was low growth, but we saw some grooming and we saw a lot of voice choices that were made by our customers to say, okay, we've been running dual systems with regard to VoIP or with regard to wireless, or reconfiguring our operations. We run a lot of backup systems from our legacy products, and so we've gone to strategic. Now we're going to groom those off. So we did see that. That's correct. We adjusted our marketing plans and our sales teams, and set out some set up a group of folks who are going to specifically address those issues. What I would suggest to you is that we're certainly hopeful and expect that you know, revenue losses will change, but the key here for us is to get the business fixed investment going again in the economy, and that'll drive that strategic service growth. We would hope to get it back to where it was just a year, 2 years ago, in the 12 and the 15% range. We're almost to the tipping point. We're at 40% of that revenue stream is in strategic services. We can get that over to the tipping point where it's the majority of it and have those kinds of growth rates at 8 and 10% there, you can see where that's a very vibrant business.
You've talked about SD-WAN for a long time, mm-hmm. Mostly as a cost savings opportunity as an operator. Mm-hmm. But it's a double-edged sword, I suppose, in that your customers can look at it as a price-saving opportunity.
Right.
Can you talk about what your thoughts are about SD-WAN? Is that a net positive? Is it a net negative? And when does it start to show up in your commercial wireline numbers?
Yeah, we're starting to see it now. We're starting to see SD-WAN providers want to talk to us about doing deals together with us. You're right. On an embedded base, there's some risk, but quite frankly, that risk on some of the legacy services might be there anyway. And so from our perspective, protecting that base by not looking to the future is not as opposed to looking to the future, we're going to always look to the future. So we have made some investments in SD-WAN. We're looking forward to making it part of our product offering, understanding that giving customers better quality service internally leads to them buying more products and services from you. It may not change the total revenue picture, but it does change the stickiness and the quality of service, and then using it as a tool for new business outside of our existing footprint.
Okay, got it. So I'm going to zoom out a little bit now to some bigger picture issues. One of the themes that everybody wants to talk about at this conference is M&A. You're involved in a big transaction, so in some ways you're
we're going to be careful.
More of an observer. If I look at the wireless business, do you think consolidation is possible in wireless? Horizontal consolidation is possible in wireless? You guys have some experience of the regulatory process there. Is it possible, and what would that do to industry dynamics if you got it?
Certainly it's possible, and so we'll see, but certainly it's possible. I'm not suggesting any likeliness one way or the other. If you think about what we do and what's happening today, we've talked a lot about millimeter wave, we talked about fiber, we talked about 5G. These networks take an extensive amount of investment. And so from that perspective, when you have high capital intensity type business, it makes sense to have a rational number of rational competitors. That would be good for the market, that would be good for customers, the quality of service and capabilities, as well as good for investors. So there's some logic there. Secondly, it's a new FCC, so I would leave it to people who know more about how they might think about it, but it's not the FCC I think we'd all agree that we had dealt with for most of the past 4 or 5 years or the last 8 years. And so it would be interesting to see how they might view it. Third, some of the players are facing financial challenges. And so that is, one reasonable process to evaluate in this situation.
I know with a huge transaction like Time Warner on your plate, it's hard to, as a CFO, to even imagine what comes next. But we already hear people talking about, well, what about the synergies that could come from the satellite business with Dish Network or more content, or is there a sort of, how do you think about the different options that come after Time Warner?
So the first thing is probably paying down some debt. That's the first thing. That's the thing that comes first. We're going to have a great, tremendous cash generation machine when we combine these assets. So let me get that out first. That'll be our focus. But if you look at things like what comes next, well, quite frankly, we need to get through the fiber tower and work through in a very respectful manner, the FCC, to get approval for that. But then we'll look to that auction that's going to be coming up probably here, hopefully by the end of 18, but certainly early in
the millimeter wave auction.
Yeah, they've got 1,400 megahertz of spectrum they're auctioning off. I would assume that anybody who buys Straight Path wouldn't be interested in buying any more, or maybe limited. So that participation in that gives us an easy path to finish that off. You'll think of things like that. It's a very easy, doable
but
project.
You mean with respect to balance sheet planning and...
Yeah, so you think about that. I mean, you do think about any ways to do cost savings. You think about, do I have to own all the real estate I own? And this is focused on AT&T real estate as well as Time Warner real estate, just that normal course. We look through your portfolio and look to evaluate, what things fit and what don't and so forth. That's an ongoing process. With regard to cost-sharing activities, that makes sense. Certainly, those are reasonable questions for people to ask.
So a cost-sharing, in this case, with Dish Network, for example, where you might be able to do some cost-sharing with Dish Network?
That's a very reasonable question to ask, and we'll wait till we get our Time Warner transaction through the process to kind of go into speculation on any specific items. But I understand the issue. I mean, back in 2000 when SBC had a less than national footprint and Bell South had a less than national footprint, and we brought those two companies together and operated a great wireless company called Singular. So we've looked to those things in those ways in the past. I'm not suggesting this is anything like that. I'm just saying right now we're going to stay focused on the Time Warner transaction and make sure we focus on that.
So if I pull all this together, and I think about the portfolio of assets you've got, which really has transformed quite a lot over the last few years, at least if I include Time Warner as,
sure.
as in that bundle. So I'm looking here. I have my AT&T plan here. How do we
Can
think
you show of, that logo to the crowd, please?
How do we think about the portfolio growth story for a second and the path to GDP? I mean, right now you've got a very large wireless business, but that business is facing some pressure and is still a negative revenue growth business. I've got a wireline business that's quite large, but is still a negative revenue growth business. And DirecTV is about at the water, the entertainment segment in general is about at the waterline. How do I think about the trajectory back to growth for AT&T and the GDP growth target?
Gotcha. So let me start off in the simplest order for me is you look at Latin America and Mexico, and you look at what we've been doing. I mentioned it earlier, but Mexico has been a really great growth engine for customer counts. Constant currency revenue growth is significant, and we're getting through that investment phase. We've got 85 million POPs built, and we're in effective markets where we have distribution and marketing and a great network. So we're ready to grow that business, and there's real opportunities there, and we're doing it today. And we've changed that game down there for those properties. Latin America is doing well, generating cash. It's operating in a tough economic and political environment, but it's doing really well. So those are first ones, particularly Mexico, real good growth opportunity. Secondly, on mobility, as we get the first net built out, the Internet of Things, the connected devices that continue to play in this space of prepaid, and quite frankly, the capabilities that will come from having Time Warner skill set from curation of video and other things, and those abilities, especially with this tremendously deep network, we feel very good about that. On the broadband side, as you pointed out, the IP broadband, the expansion of the fiber, the ability that it's growing today, it grew in the quarter, that continued opportunity growth. Strategic services, growth at 8%, we'd hope to get that up higher, but that growth at 8% on 40% of our wireless revenues. We're talking about the legacy services. We're going to continue to face some of that challenge. It'll be there. We're not suggesting it's going to stop, so we're going to have to get through that process, convert as many of those voice customers to wireless, convert as many of those voice customers to VoIP, get those DSLs up to IP broadband and so forth. We're going through that the change in our life process, so to speak. But then you go over to our next business and you look at Time Warner and you think, wow, they grew revenues, I think last quarter 6%, and did a tremendous job with profitability. And then when you bring those two businesses together, that content and that distribution data, and you think about the opportunities to grow revenue from or profitability from the data knowledge about choosing products or projects in time in Warner Studios, and how you advertise and the ARPUs you get from our CPGMs you get from Turner or for Turner, all of that, that's a tremendous opportunity. So that's how I think about it. Let's be straightforward. We have some legacy services that we'll continue to pay attention and try to manage very effectively, but they are legacy services. We're looking forward, though, with everything else, to those next generation's software-defined products and services. And I think we're doing a pretty good job of being very pragmatic while also looking forward.
And so a little nearer in for 2017, talk about kind of the puts and takes of your 2017 EPS guidance.
Yeah, so, I mean, you think about it, the investment cycle last year in Mexico was about $1 billion. The simplest put, our guidance is in the mid-single digits EPS growth. If you think about cutting that in half as an illustration, that's $500 million or 5 cents a share on our business. That's 2% growth just by the change in the trends there. Not suggesting that's the only thing. I'm just suggesting that that is what's there. Second, if you look at what we've been doing, we've been the big iron costs are what we call ATNO, our network operations and our technology group, is year over year reducing costs in real dollars, And that from software-defined networks, from network function virtualization, from automation, digitization. I can give you examples of, payment arrangements and credit arrangement programs through my credit collection where We used to do 20% of those automated and 80% manual. Now it's flipped. I mean, millions of calls going away, or millions of opportunities to automate things. All of those things, you've seen us continue to maintain margins in a challenged economic environment. That's going to continue. As a factoid, 34% at the end of the year of our network functions were virtualized. We'll be to 55% by the end of this year. Think about what cost savings that brings. And you can start paying for the savings of the prior work you've done, start paying for this investment. Last year, I was just paying for we were paying for the investment to get up to 34. Now that 34 is fully generating huge amounts of savings and is a self-funder of things going forward. We have those kinds of things throughout our business. Our big iron team, as my boss likes to call them, is doing a really great job.
We're just about out of time, so I want to leave it with just an opportunity for you with current and potential investors in the room. What should they be thinking differently about AT&T, and how do you make the case for why they should own AT&T at this valuation?
Yeah, we're that next generation company. Our strategy is as sound as any strategy out there, and as forward looking. We have the assets assembled. We have the customer base that's uncomparable. And with the Time Warner, we'll have all the assets, not just the distribution, but the content, that we have an ability to take this collection of assets and dramatically grow the profitability of this business. The indicators are all there, if you will, the network quality, the network savings, the FirstNet transaction, the content cost, the advertising capabilities, the growth in Mexico, all of the indicators are there. And so it's a very exciting opportunity for us, and we're looking forward to get going and get after it.
John, I can't thank you enough for being here today. It's been a pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you back here next year.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.